So, welcome to the first day of the Postgraduate Researcher Conference at Durham. We are talking to the keynote for that conference, which is a very impressive sound, Paul Stafford. And I don't have a set of questions this time, so I'm going to just ask Paul to kick off with an introduction to who you are and what you do.
Thank you. Yes, as you said, Paul Stafford. My grand title is PGR Enterprise Development Manager.
Ooh.
Hang on a second.
Yes. You won't hear that because you don't have the headphones on, but I just kicked in the applause button.
And yes, I work at the Venture Lab, which is housed in the Maths and Computing building. And we are here for any student or graduate who thinks they've got an idea. And that ranges from people who come with a very small, is this a good idea, to people who are actually out there making a difference in the world and helping them to have proper impact. My particular aspect of this is supporting the PhD students in order to help them understand what entrepreneurial thinking is, in the hope that they may think then about startup and spin out, but really it's about how you can be entrepreneurial within your own setting and your own context.
So was that more or less what you were talking about with them this morning?
Yeah. And we use two particular frameworks or theories, depending on how you'd like to frame it. One is effectuation, which was created by Sarasvati, of which there's five strands to that. But basically it's who you are, what you know, and whom you know, and seeing those as resources.
And I guess from what I'm taking from what you're saying, there's really two ways that a PhD student might want to think about entrepreneurship. One is developing the skills that are going to be useful for them once they've finished.
Certainly.
And that's always a big dip, is you finish your PhD and you had all these, you've really, everything in your life's on hold, and then you just finish it and you go, right, what happens next?
Yeah.
So to be thinking about that before you get to that point really takes you over that blip quite effectively.
Yeah.
But the other thing I'm interested in is how you use entrepreneurship actually within your PhD. And do you cover that at all?
Yeah, well, I think the whole point is to allow people to think about their skills, knowledge, understanding, passions, motivations as resources, and for them to decide where the entrepreneurial thinking is going to be applied, rather than us being didactic in this is the way to do it. So it's giving them the tools to then reimagine it. But the entrepreneurial thinking within a PhD could be entrepreneurial thinking in engagement as you're going through this, or perhaps entrepreneurial thinking in how you reach out to respondents, where are they and how are they going to find you. So and thinking outside of the box is a trite phrase, but it's that sort of approach.
And also that inner reflection. I think one of the things that I was thinking about this morning was what would be my main things about me doing a PhD, and it was finding your passion. Because it's so much more motivating. You've got, for me, it was 5 years because I was doing it part-time, but that slog of getting through the dips where it's not quite working, that if you're doing something that you are genuinely, personally fascinated by, that makes it that much more interesting for you and capable of finishing it, because it's more difficult to finish if you're not passionate about it. And also that's the thing that's going to carry you on once you've finished it into maybe a new career or whatever, because you've really worked at the thing that you want to do more of once you've finished your PhD.
Exactly. And we try to go even a step beyond that. And a phrase that I often use with my day-to-day work is, if you never want to work again, do something that you love. Mm-hmm. And so all the things that you said about a PhD, absolutely on board with that. But also, if you can reimagine that into what your career will look like, so that you're bounding out of bed because you absolutely love it, because you've combined all these elements that are you in a unique way that nobody else quite combines them in the same way.
So what advice would you give somebody now listening to this, a PGR researcher? What would your sort of main suggestions to them at this point be?
I think the obvious thing is come and talk to us at Adventure Lab. And just to reassure anybody who is listening, yes, we get people coming to say, I've got this idea, what do I do with it? But we equally, particularly PhD students, coming to me to say, so what's all this about then? Why is it this of interest? What does entrepreneurial thinking mean? And that's also valuable.
And another thing that I think that you do, I think it's something that I've got out of sitting in on your sessions and things, is these are all the things I do. Oh, that one's entrepreneurship. And yes, then rethinking it in those terms and then seeing other opportunities because of what you're already doing and thinking, oh, yeah, I'm being entrepreneurial. I mean, this podcast is entrepreneurship in a way.
Exactly, yeah.
In that it's expanded into different things and we've followed the passion and kind of been adaptive to what things have come up. Mm-hmm. And reframing it in that context, I think, then can expand it. Well, it makes that whole being an entrepreneur less daunting because you can see more ways in which people are already doing it.
Yeah, and I'm sure you've come across the term intrapreneur.
It's new.
No, well, it's being entrepreneurial as an employee. And that's exactly. So you're an intrapreneur because you're doing it within the confines of your day-to-day work.
I shouldn't be. I don't get paid to be a podcaster. I'm sneaking it in here and there.
Yeah,
but hopefully nobody at Durham's listening. It's
still entrepreneurial and intrapreneurial because you're expanding your reach. You're using what you love.
It has
opportunity. Yeah, the network, all of that, and that's exactly how I've used it as well. So as you know, and we maybe haven't touched on it so far, the pop culture program that I created came out of thinking more widely about what are my skills and what's my interest and what's the impact that I want to have. Mm. And in full transparency, I'm a complete geek and nerd, 60s child, love Star Trek and Doctor Who and all sorts of things. And seeing that as a resource to be able to then get more people interested to find out what entrepreneurial thinking is in a way that is valuable to them. And again, not being instructive on what that means.
Well, I think it was something you were doing and you mentioned Star Trek, and suddenly there's one 60-year-old at the back suddenly goes, Star Trek? Which is me. And he's like, oh, I'm wearing Star Trek boots, cool. And and finding ways to trigger people's passion, even if it's not directly related, but can be related. But
two people at the end of the talk this morning came to me to say how much they identified with the Star Trek and science fiction links.
Yeah.
And it really spoke to them. And if nothing else, it's kept them interested for the 45 minutes that I was talking, but also hopefully has made them think that this is a resource that they could use in a similar way, and maybe empower more people to think like that.
Yeah, it's like Sarah with her tapestry work, and it's exactly, like, this is what I do as a hobby, as a craft that I do, but I can then bring that in as an element of my work.
Yes,
and I think there's loads of things like that.
And of course, we haven't even touched on the toilet rolls, have we?
Oh, no. But yeah, so there's all the things you can do, and that's just anything, any small thing, like the matchbox thing that people are doing today is, what can you put inside a matchbox that would summarize who you are?
Mm-hmm.
Anything like that. Yeah. And that combination of, here's a constraint, but you can go in any direction with it, is a really nice combination to get.
Yes, completely. Yes.
Right then, Paul, if people want to get in touch, they can find Venture Lab on the Durham website, can they?
They can, yes. And I'm easily findable on LinkedIn or indeed on just the internal directory. And I'm very, very willing to just have an exploratory chat. And the tea and coffee is on tap, kettles on, at the Venture Lab.
That is good coffee, I will say that. As a coffee snob, I'm very happy with the coffee that was up there. So thanks, Paul.
My pleasure. Okay. It's been lovely.
Yeah, I'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, okay, lovely.
Bye then.
Thanks.
Right, well, we're back on our second chat of today at the Postgraduate Researcher Conference. I got that right, didn't I?
Almost. It's the Researcher Development Conference.
Oh, yeah, I think I might have got that wrong the first time as well. So, and this time we're talking to Martina Deal, who is one of the organisers of the conference. And
yes.
Martina, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're doing for the conference?
Yeah, so I'm Academic Development Advisor in DCAD. I generally design and put on workshop sessions to help researchers develop themselves as researcher, with always community at the heart of it and a dialogic practice, which is kind of my background in education as well. So I love critical pedagogy and dialogue and getting people to talk to each other and learn by building on their own experience and their shared experiences. My role in the conference, I've been the lead organiser this year, which has been really good fun.
Hang on, I've got an applause button, which I used last time. I'm going to use it this time as well. Which you won't hear because you don't have the headphones on.
I hear it slightly. Yeah, so I've let myself be inspired by playful learning conferences that I've been to and by playful learning events that I've been to and the Playful Learning Festival in Denmark that I recently went to, and let myself be inspired by all the activities there and how those activities helped researchers connect and help people connect. And I've put some of those activities into the day.
So that's where the matchbox thing comes from. Do you want to tell us about the matchbox thing and how that works and what that's for?
So all PGRs in their welcome pack have got a blank matchbox, and they get to decorate it. So they've got some stickers in their pack as well, but there's also some stickers and paper and pens lying around in the general area. And they personalise their matchbox basically as a talking point to talk about themselves and to connect with others. Maybe they have some shared interests in that box hidden away. I was introduced to that in Denmark, and I thought it was such a good idea for just a very simple, quick thing that people can make to then start a conversation off with. So, yeah, I thought we'd give it a go.
So, yeah, from what I know about that whole kind of creativity, playful thing, one of the sort of sweet spots for getting those sorts of activities going is having it open-ended but having constraints as well. So I guess that really hits that, is because you're constrained by size, they're small matchboxes, but also it's open-ended because you can put anything you like into them that would fit in within a matchbox.
Yeah, you can stick things in them, you can just put things in them, you can see where it takes you. So there's a lot of freedom there, but there's also a very clear purpose as like the business matchbox.
So what is the main thing you want people to take away from the conference?
So the theme of the conference is connect, reflect, empower, enjoy. And I would like all the PGRs to feel like they've made stronger connections within their PGR community. They've been able to reflect on their own research journey and try new things, try different things as well, to allow them to feel empowered on that research journey and to allow them to enjoy the research journey. I think there's still this feeling that academia has to be tough and hard and therefore you can't always enjoy it. But actually, it's especially the PhD part is one of the things I got out of it. It was learning how to learn and learning how I like to learn and how I enjoy learning. And that opened up a whole new world for me that I wouldn't have figured out without it. So hopefully I'll have made a start today in helping them find their way to enjoy their research journey as well.
One of the things I was talking to Paul about was finding your passion, because if you find something you're passionate about, it gets you over all of the difficult demotivating bits, because it's still fun or it's still interesting. Or I mean, that's what I switched my PhD topic after the end of my first year, because the first one was absolutely tedious. I hated it. And then I found something that was really exciting and I switched to that. And it was so much easier to just do the next bit of work on it. And as Paul was saying, if you find that during your PhD and you get to do that as your domain after you've finished it, then you can have fun for the rest of your career, which is really good.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you're not, Martina's nodding to this, so you recognise that as your own sort of experience pathway to your PhD.
Yeah, when I started my PhD, part-time. And when I started, I had two supervisors, and one of them was very much ingrained in this critical pedagogy, and all our supervisor meetings were very dialogic. And then he retired and I got a new set of supervisors, and they were very different people, very lovely people, very supportive people, but very different. And it made me change my research focus slightly because I wanted to work with what their skill set was as well. So one of my supervisors was very knowledgeable on thematic analysis, and the other one on productive thinking and creative thinking. So I built the critical pedagogy into the productive thought process by Doug Newton, who works at the university. And it was quite an interesting journey from that point, because that was a big shift. But then I had another big shift quite near the end of my PhD journey, where I discovered a thing called poetic inquiry. And I thought, this is making my research a lot more fun. I really struggled with the thematic analysis and trying to bring it together, and it felt quite tedious and daunting, and I didn't understand the boundaries of it and the shape I wanted to give it and the narrative that I wanted to form out of that. And then the poetic inquiry came into my life at a Playful Learning conference, actually, where I went to a session around that. I thought, ooh, this sounds like my thing. And it really was. And so then I started to use the poetic inquiry as a method, and it drew out all the data so beautifully, and it made me really excited about presenting the data for the first time, like throughout my whole PhD time. So after 7 years, I sort of discovered this thing and I was like, ah, this is great. So yeah, definitely had those shifts as well within my research to make it fun.
Yeah, and that fun, it sort of disrupts the normal power dynamics as well, which is partly what's wrong with academia. And the more people we can get through the process who are also playful, having fun, being a bit disruptive, not taking themselves too seriously, the better things will be going in the future, I guess.
It provides space to really develop your own unique academic journey.
And voice. All those sorts of things. So if there's one piece of advice you'd like people to take away from either this chat or the conference, what would it be, do you think?
I guess to find the fun and enjoyability. I mean, we talked about fun at the Playful Learning meeting at Northumbria, how we shouldn't really use that as a word. We should reward.
I think you can say you are having fun, but to tell somebody to do this, it will be fun, that's the death knell.
I think to find the fun and find the reward that keeps you motivated throughout your PhD journey or your doctoral journey.
Because if you get that right now, hopefully you'll get it right for the rest of...
And try new things, try different things. I think that's my other thing.
Yeah, not necessarily with a particular goal in mind, but because being open to new things may help you unexpectedly discover new things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. That was more profound than I was expecting.
Yay!
Yay! Profundity, we do profundity, Martina and I sometimes.
We chats.
So, okay, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let you go back to the conference. Lead organiser. And if people want to know more about what you do or about the PGR program or whatever.
Yeah, so we have a Teams for other PGRs, for PGR postgraduate research students, I think it's called, where we update on key workshops and highlights that are coming up. We also send out a weekly email. We have a SharePoint page too. And for my own things, I haven't published lots yet. I've published something in Danish, which, you know, if you're Danish or if you speak Danish, you can go and find that.
Okay. I know two words in Danish. Those are pissedalig undervisning, which is piss poor teaching. That was the title of one of the sessions I went to from some Danish colleagues at the Playful Learning.
Tremendous. Yeah, I do have a Reds blog that Pete and I published with the creative workshops that we offer and why we do that and why we think it's really important for PGRs to have that opportunity to be creative.
Okay, we'll look out for that. I might even put a link in the show notes. That'd be really good. Okay, thank you, Martina.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. And now we're on to our third guest of today at the Postgraduate Development Research, Researcher Development, Postgraduate Research Development Conference.
It's a catchy name.
Yeah, I haven't got it right yet. And so we're talking to, this is the first person, you could probably tell from the first two that I knew them and worked with them a lot, Martina and Paul, but this is a stranger. No, hang on, what? A stranger is a friend I haven't met yet, or something cheesy. Anyway, do you want to tell us who you are and what you do?
Hello, my name is Job McGeehan, and I'm a comedian. And today, at the conference, I have been doing a workshop on joke writing and how to implement that in your thesis.
Oh, okay. Do you want to break that down a little bit more for us then? How do you do joke writing? How does that whole thing work?
So we were looking at the mechanics of a joke, different sorts of jokes and how jokes work and why jokes are important in presentation, in disarming people and making people feel relaxed and things like that.
So there's a specific structure to building, creating a joke then?
So we
have a quick précis of what that is?
Yes, so we were looking at the anatomy of jokes, if you like. We were talking about how the structure of every single joke comes down to the basic formula of a surprise. So you think that something's going to go one way, it goes the other way. Laughter ensues.
Right. Ideally, unless you get one of these. I'm trying them all out today. I don't need to bother with these. So, yeah, so this is why you got the rule of three, I suppose. There's like the A yeah. is the setup, B implies a pattern, and then C defies that pattern.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Do you have a favourite joke?
Yes, I do. Do you want me to tell you my favourite joke?
Yes, please.
Okay, so a... Oh, hang on. I've got to remember how it goes. Priest, an imam, and a rabbit go into a... give a blood donation centre, and the person, the phlebotomist there, goes to the rabbit and says, oh, you'd be ideal for us because you're obviously a typo.
Typo. That's good. Yeah, because it's not a rabbi.
No. And also typo. So there's double play on words there.
Wow, there's two things going on.
Two things going on there, that's which good. Is why I like it.
It's good. I like it. It's a good joke. It's good. So it's a bit of wordplay. And it's good. So that would work on two levels. A pullback and reveal and a wordplay joke.
Okay.
So we were, the joke that I initially used in this workshop was my favourite joke, which is a gentleman walks into a library, walks up to the librarian and says, can I have a portion of fish and chips, please? And the librarian says, what are you doing? This is a library. And he goes, oh, sorry. Can I have a portion of fish and chips, please?
Very good. Yes. So, yeah. And again, if you wanted to deal with the anatomy of that, it would be, well, you think the mistake's going to be that he's in the wrong place, and it's not. He thinks the mistake is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it should be quiet. No, I just remembered another one. It was the one that Bob Mortimer won, last person laughing at for the first season one. And it was...
The graveyard
one.
which is, again,
a double play, double word play thing.
Yeah.
Like, walking through the graveyard and somebody steps up from behind a gravestone and the guy says, morning. And the other one says, no, just taking a shit.
Yeah, see, what he's done there, it's a double subvert. Yeah. You know? So, yeah, so you that's why that won, you know. That's what got Richard Ayoade, because you would think he was going to say morning. No, I'm just happy to be here, whatever. Yeah. But he's added an element of absurd to that.
Yeah. And, of course, it's what also makes that funny is the delivery. And I guess that's one thing that's more difficult to break down when you're doing one of these sessions is how to tell a joke is one thing, but how to be funny is another thing as well. So there's intonation and all that sort of thing, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard to cover in an hour.
Oh, yeah. So did you get people telling jokes?
We had people writing jokes and telling jokes and drawing comics and things like that. It was good, yeah.
So how does this then build into the PhD? It helps with presenting. Does it help with actually being a researcher in some way, that kind of level of creativity?
Absolutely. I'll give you an example.
Please do.
Let's say that you were doing a thesis in history, and you were learning about history, and you're learning about what the ancient Greeks did and all the things that they said and all the different people there. I did a thing at Newcastle Castle where I was learning about medieval jokes, trying to find the oldest jokes in history. Mm-hmm. And I found this joke from ancient Greece, and the joke was vis-a-vis a couple are together for 30, 40 years, and the wife dies, and they're laying the body to rest, and the priest or whoever at the funeral points at the body and says, so who is it that's at peace? And the husband says, that would be me.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
So now that is a joke from thousands of years ago. But when you hear that joke, you can sort of see the sort of dynamics of a interpersonal relationship in ancient Greece that you wouldn't necessarily get from just reading a book about it.
Yeah.
You know, you can sort of get a feel like, oh, they had those sort of dynamics as well. Mm-hmm. Oh, they had those sort of vibes. Oh, couples would bicker at each other and things like that. So So it gives you an insight. Jokes give you an insight that maybe just learning a binary way wouldn't give you.
Yeah, it's a sort of more folk culture, working class culture, sort of not the writer's culture, but the everybody else's. It's narrative that people will tell. There's always somebody in the pub telling a joke, and sometimes they're the funny person, sometimes they're not. But overall, it's that sense of performance that we can, most of us can do in our daily lives, I guess, that you can draw upon.
Yeah, and I say that in my workshop. We run something later on in the year as well called Bright Club, where it's a similar sort of thing, but it's over a few different sessions. And yeah, one thing that I always say in that is that everybody is telling jokes constantly all the time without knowing it, you know. It's not like singing where some people have got the talent for it and some people haven't got the talent for it. Everybody in their day-to-day life will say some things humorous. It's how people communicate, you know. And so people have things, you know, where they say about where, like, for example, when I introduce myself, I always say that my name's Joby. It's like Toby with a J, you know. Or I might say, oh, I'm called Joby. I've got this name because my parents are hippies, you know.
Yeah.
So it's just not something that I'm even conscious of, but it's just little things that you just pepper your dialogue with, and it is because it puts people at ease and it makes people feel comfortable. And you know,
is that cross-cultural as well though?
Absolutely. And when we were looking at the medieval jokes, obviously that was one was from ancient Greece, but there's other ones from other parts of Europe and even Africa and things like that, where they have separate little jokes that they do all the time as part of normal conversations, part of as part of the culture.
Cool. So you said that you do Bright Club as well. Are there other things that you do as part of the postgraduate program as well?
So with Bright Club, what we do is we do an actual comedy show. I don't know if you've
heard of it. Yeah, I've not been able to make one yet, but yeah.
So what we do is we get PhD students that have never done comedy before. And we work with them on workshops, and the end product is an actual comedy night, in front of actual people actually expecting comedy. And they will do a 5 to 10 minute comedy set for the first time in front of people about their thesis, about what they're doing, which sounds like it might be sort of an unnatural form of comedy, but it's actually how everybody starts comedy, because everybody's first set is, this is who I am. This is an introduction to me.
This is what I've been doing. Yeah. All these are funny things.
Yeah, exactly.
Do all theses kind of lend themselves to that, though?
Some more than others.
Yeah.
Yeah. So some you hear it and think, well, that definitely has, I mean, one guy whose thesis was, part of his thesis was he would study people having sexual intercourse in an MRI machine.
Okay.
Which I've straight away thought, well, you've got a gold mine there, surely.
Yeah.
But it actually turns out it's quite an arduous and administrative procedure, you know. And then there's other people where they're doing anthropology or whatever, and you think, there was one person that was doing like finance and things, and you know, what's going to be here? Or there's a person doing a thing on, there's a girl that was doing law. I thought, well, that could be sort of tricky for comedy. And she had this amazing, hilarious set, you know, and it was all about sort of how she's, if any of her friends are going through a divorce, she passes them a business card and things like that, you know. It's just,
There's always some humour somewhere, and you can mine that for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Even if there's only one thing, you can mine it for 5 minutes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, cool. So, standard question. People want to know more about what you do. How do they get in touch? How do they find out more about what you do?
Yeah, well, I am a stand-up comedian, which means I'm on all of the things. I'm on everything, you know. I've got videos out there and stuff like that, and I do comedy gigs. I will be performing at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Oh, well, good luck with that.
Yeah.
Is that the first time?
No, I do all
I do it every year.
I say all the time, just once a year.
Once a year.
The amount of times. Year. Yeah. I do that. When I can afford to. Other times you can't. And I'm performing a solo show at the Standard Comedy Club in September as well.
Oh, okay. Oh, cool. So everybody look out for that one. Right. Yeah. So thank you, Joby. I hope you've had a good time here.
It's been good. Yeah. Have you enjoyed it?
I have, yeah. Yeah, I got to tell my favourite joke, two favourite jokes, which is always a good thing. Right then. Okay. Thank you very much.
All the best,
okay,
mate. Thank you.
Bye. So, fourth chat of the day. And we've got the first poster presentation person. So that's good. And I have done no preamble, no chat. So I don't know anything about the person I'm speaking to. So this is going to be as completely fresh to me as it is to you. So over to you. So do you want to tell us who you are and what you're doing?
Yeah, so I'm Grace McCabe. I am a first year PhD student in the Centre for Neurodiversity and Development. And my project focuses on online safety and social vulnerability for children, young people with Williams syndrome.
Oh, okay. So child security and safety online is very hot topic at mm-hmm. the moment. I guess you're feeling quite ambivalent about that in a way because of everything people are saying and how clueless a lot of the stuff is in yeah. the discussion.
That's obviously thrown it's a little bit of a curveball in terms of my kind of plans for what to do. One of the main things we've been thinking about lately is the fact that neurodivergent young people have been really left out in the development of the new regulations that we're talking about. So a lot of the government output has really been emphasising that they've got sort of 100,000 responses and they've talked to parents and children and experts and everyone loves it and everyone agrees with it, which, you know, they would say it's their policy. But there's been kind of no mention of whether we've thought about the needs of different groups of children and how neurodivergent children might especially be affected. We've seen quite a few things on social media from sort of parents of children with additional needs and things like autism that a ban from social media can be quite harmful for them. The neurodiversity movement itself was started online. It's how people sort of found each other. It does a lot of awareness raising through online campaigns and things. And so a loss of access to that can really be quite detrimental for young people, and especially young people who find the internet a lot easier as a space to communicate with other people. Than they do maybe in person, where you have to kind of really attend to someone's body language and reply in the right tone and at the right time.
Yeah, and as usual, decisions made for neurodivergent people without asking any neurodivergent people to contribute to the research. Mm-hmm. So how's that changed what you're doing then? Where'd you got to with your thesis? You said first year, so I'm guessing you were just doing literature review.
I've managed to get a study done because I started on this topic last year during my master's. Primarily focusing on children, young people with Williams syndrome, which is genetic neurodevelopmental condition, which is associated with things like mild to moderate learning, disability, and kind of atypical social behaviour. So we quite often describe it as hyper-sociable. So people are really, really friendly, will kind of come and chat to you as if you're their best friend, even if they've never met you before, which can obviously present quite a bit of danger if people see that and decide to kind of take advantage, and sort of doubly online where you've got access to so many more people. So I'm working with the Williams Syndrome Foundation looking on kind of making the internet a slightly safer place for young people with Williams Syndrome so they can be a bit more involved. So last year I was comparing neurotypical young people and young people with Williams syndrome in terms of like what parents were saying they were doing online, what risks they faced, and how parents were protecting them online. And this year I've moved to comparing young people with Williams syndrome and young people with other forms, like neurodivergent conditions.
And so now that all this new stuff's come through, are you changing your research question? Have you got more data to look at? Have you adapted to this new sort of legislation?
Yeah, I have a little bit. So I'm working with the Williams Syndrome Foundation. So whatever I'm doing is ultimately kind of what fits with their members and what works for them. So it's always been a little bit up in the air in terms of if I get loads of members coming to us and saying, you know, you're focusing on the wrong age group, this is what's the big issue, or actually we think that sort of people being taken advantage of financially online is a bigger issue than socially. Like, it's always been kind of up to listening to members and what their actual kind of lived problems are. But a lot of it has been kind of able to stay the same. So I'm starting kind of a new study, which wasn't in the plans initially, asking neurodivergent children and their parents of kind of the age group that will be affected, how they feel about new restrictions and how they think it's going to affect them, purely because it's so timely and it's just not being done. Like, someone needs to do it, and it would be really useful to have kind of a snapshot of what it looks like before anything comes in. But still, I mean, the initial aim was to try and develop some sort of intervention for young people with Williams syndrome using the internet safely. And ultimately, I will still be able to do that. My age range has always been sort of up to 25. And I think one of the big issues with the new bans is that there isn't any sort of teaching provision being put in for the kids that are too young to use social media. So they get to this age and then they have access and they haven't had this maybe more sheltered way of learning it. In, you know, they live with their parents and their parents can see their phones. They're getting access as they're getting more independence in kind of every other area as well. When I've talked to people, we've found ourselves comparing it to things like drinking alcohol. So you always hear about, you know, kind of 18-year-olds who've never been allowed a drink. Yeah. And then they go out in Freshers Week and it's just a complete mess and they get into all sorts of trouble and they have sort of a really rough time of it. Whereas young people who kind of before they go off and they're given all this massive independence have been allowed to try and experiment in spaces where their parents are kind of more around. I think there is kind of a comparison to be made there in terms of like taking more risks in an environment where you have got parents, you have got people you can talk to, is a safer way of doing it than just deciding that at 18 you know everything, even though you've had no sort of prior exposure.
So how do you feel about, is that making it more exciting? Is it making it more more daunting? How's that as far as a participant, as a PhD researcher, is that?
I'm definitely probably getting a bit more infuriated reading the news than I would be otherwise. There's a lot of it that I'm reading. I'm thinking, well, hang on, how is that going to work? That's not what I've seen from the people that I talk to. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff about, you know, we're going to ban children from talking to strangers online. There's nothing to say how they're going to ensure someone is a stranger versus someone that they know offline.
Mm.
You know, if you add someone, are they not a stranger anymore, even if you haven't met them, sort of thing? And as well, sort of removing access to strangers doesn't really remove access to danger. There's a lot of the parents I've talked to have talked a lot about how bullying from school has transferred online, or someone that they've kind of known offline has gone and then victimized them online in various different ways. And so I think there's a lot of the focus on kind of the danger comes from strangers. It's all strangers. Yeah. Whereas really, like, a lot of it does come from people that they know offline.
Because that's the thing, that they, by excluding people, is the benefits going to be taken away. There's kids now feeling this, that it's going to be taken away from for no really well thought out reason. Well, I'm sorry, I'm telling you the stuff that you already know, but this is making me angry as well now. So is that what you were going to say?
Yeah, there's a lot of benefit into, especially with Williams syndrome, because as a condition, it's sort of 1 in 20,000 people. And so for a lot of kids with Williams syndrome, if they want to talk to someone who, you know, understands what it's like to have Williams syndrome, they're talking to someone from a different city or even like the next town over. For a lot of, you know, younger kids, they're not going to be able to navigate that by themselves. They're relying on parents to have that. Another thing that came up a lot was for children in SEND schools and special schools that have sort of a much larger catchment area, because, you know, there's less children that need the support. Their friends live miles away from them. And so when they move to these schools from a mainstream school, they go from maybe having a couple friends on the street that they can go out and talk to their friends living much further away. And so if they want to kind of contact these friends, they're reliant on the internet.
Yeah. And that's all going to go.
There's a lot of government stuff saying, you know, we're giving the power back to parents and we're holding tech companies accountable, which I had to kind of stand up from my desk and walk away for a minute when I read, because I think that it doesn't really give parents the power. It maybe gives parents a bit more power if they want their children to stay off, in that, you know, their children don't have the excuse of saying, oh, well, everyone does it. But for parents who want their children to be able to use these platforms, they don't have that option without, you know, potentially being punished for that. It's, they haven't really expressed, you know, what happens if you break these rules, what happens if you help someone who's under 16 to access social media, but there's potentially risk put on them. And I think ultimately it's not punishing big companies, it's punishing children, really, yeah, by just kind of taking them out of it.
And not all children at risk have parents who are looking out for them. That's partly why they're at risk. So giving parents more control as a blanket approach is actually putting some kids at more risk, because the parents, they can't have a phone that they can hide from their parents or whatever, and contact the help that they need. It's,
yeah, we saw a lot of this after the Online Safety Act last year, with things when it, you know, blocked inappropriate content for children. It kind of had a knock-on of blocking a lot of information to do with sort of LGBTQ issues from young people, and it was labelled as sort of inappropriate. And I think for, there must have been children who have maybe a less supportive home environment, or just kind of a less informed home environment, who really could have benefited from those resources and from that online community, who have been sort of locked out of it.
Yeah, okay, so let's lifting the mood slightly. If you were going to pass on any advice to other researchers or people thinking about doing a PhD or whatever, based on what you've kind of learnt so far, I know you're very early on, but what would that be?
Setting Google alerts for, for upcoming things that are probably going to be really impactful.
So it's finding something impactful, you think, is the good approach. Find something that matters and matters to you.
Yeah, finding the problem that you sort of care about. As well, like, kind of talking to people on their level. I try and do a lot with sort of public engagement and learning about that, and learn about adapting results for various groups. And I've started to try and practice it a little bit. I've got sort of research social media, but it's difficult to reach people, and I've not found kind of an exact solution for it yet. But I think the way to get people to kind of care about what you're doing is to meet them where they are, instead of just sort of directing them to whatever paper that you've written, because people don't have the time.
Is there anything you've got from the PGR program so far that's helped with that?
I think, like, meeting people's been really helpful, and I went straight through from my undergrad, so I've never sort of had a chance to, you know, work in anything other than kind of academic spaces, and it's been really interesting to meet people who've done all these different things and have all this experience, who can kind of give you a nudge to kind of get back on the right track based on what they've seen, sort of thing.
So if people want to know more about the work you're doing or the research, is there a way they can get in touch and find out, or a site somewhere where you're sharing this?
Yeah, so I've got a research Instagram account which is called Williams Syndrome Online.
Okay, so people can go onto Insta, Williams.
Williams Syndrome Online, oh, Williams and there's an underscore online between each of them.
Oh, okay.
I don't think there's any sort of similar account
names. I'll find you anyway, so yeah, that's good. Well, thank you very much. That was enlightening, infuriating, and really interesting in equal measures there. Great, thank you.